started. Just a couple of preliminary matters. First, this matter is being recorded, and there will be an audio recording that is placed on our website after the oral argument. To that end, there are no other recordings allowed during today's hearing. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your initial argument with a 5-minute rebuttal for the appellant. I will, in a moment, call the cases and we will move forward. With that, Madam Clerk, if you can call the first case.
The first case is A242026, Todd A. Weidrich et al. Respondents versus Michael S. Horn, appellant.
And counsel for appellant, you can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Eric Hansen. I represent the appellant in this matter, Michael Horn. This case involves a dispute over real property in Otter Tail County, and the dispute centers on whether the boundary between two parcels of farmland is consistent with the recorded deed, or if it is instead defined by a partial fence and field line. And I think the first thing that I want to emphasize to the court on this point is that the district court erred in a number of important ways here. And ultimately, it is the combination, the compounding of this, the errors that require reversal here, and not those in isolation. The first of those errors that I want to talk about is the procedural posture, how this came forward. This was decided, this case is decided ultimately on a motion for reconsideration. And that motion for reconsideration raises for the first time a claim of boundary by express agreement. And simply put, raising a new claim, one that could have been pled in the initial, is simply not allowed under Rule 115.11 of the General Rules of Practice.
Mr. Hansen, help me understand why we shouldn't conclude that appellant has waived his argument that respondents did not argue or present evidence of boundary by practical location through express agreement prior to seeking reconsideration.
I recognize that there's some discussion before the court about it, and I think that if you read those statements to the court carefully, ultimately what's being said is there was some discussion about whether there was an agreement. That doesn't allow for there to be a claim, especially a claim under Rule 115.11.
Well, but help me understand, Mr. Hansen. I'm reading directly from your client's response to the reconsideration motion. And I'm quoting, in this case, defendant Michael Horn will not take issue with plaintiff's argument that plaintiffs did, in fact, seek to establish the boundary between plaintiffs and defendants' respective properties via the doctrine of boundary by practical location by express agreement at the trial of this matter. That seems to me to be an acknowledgement of what, frankly, the record might otherwise support, and that is a determination that this issue was raised in the first instance. Why am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, I don't think that, I don't think that you can waive it. I don't think that the boundaries of Rule 115.11 allows that. I don't think that the court, my understanding of what the rules for reconsideration allow is that you cannot add a new claim that could be pled. So whether or not counsel said that was argued during the trial or not, which I think is ultimately really a semantics game. I think the point, as I understood, as I read what you're quoting and in talking to trial counsel, was there was clearly a lot of testimony about it. The point is simply that they never pled it in their complaint. You go back to their original complaint, they ask for adverse possession and boundary by practical location. And so then the question becomes, what is the tool that can put a claim for express agreement in front of the court? And I would submit that they could have done that. They could have amended, but they can't bring a motion for reconsideration. and bring that claim at that point.
Well, and again, then let's address sort of the merits of this issue. And I mean, I understand what you say, that the original complaint is very broad, right? It just references adverse possession, practical location, or otherwise. I mean, it's very vague, but we have testimony, I mean, highlighted, objected to testimony about the existence of an express agreement that I am selling you this property west of this fence and field division that I've been recognizing for the last 6 years. But so we have that testimony, which was highlighted. Plus, we have the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law that expressly reference the boundary by practical location through an express agreement. So I'm having a hard time understanding why we should conclude that respondents didn't raise this issue.
Because they didn't plead it, Your Honor. I think you're right. I mean, when we look at the complaint, item number one, court asks determine that the fence is the legal boundary between defendant's property and plaintiff's property, whether by adverse possession, practical location, or otherwise. And I don't think "or otherwise" is sufficient to say, well, we've got an express agreement here. And I think the problem that this case represents is that they just went forward with this and made these claims, and put in whatever evidence they could get in, and then went looking for legal theories after the fact. And I think that's just not our system. And respectfully,
If I may, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding something. It sounds that you're asking us to rule based on the language of Rule 115, right? So
in
let me ask.
part.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay. And then if the respondents had moved to amend to conform to the evidence that was taken during the bench trial, would you have the same argument?
I think I wouldn't. I think that there may have been procedural vehicles that they did not avail themselves that they could have, but did not. I'm sorry, Your Honor, your audio is hard to pick up.
Sorry, let me see if I can fix that. Can you hear me now?
I can when you're leaning forward, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. So let me ask you if it would have made a difference under what rule the respondents moved, then how does that factor in with your response to the motion to reconsider, which, as you know, Judge Brockman read, you essentially said, you know, this issue was presented. Aren't you in fact acquiescing or waiving that the issue was tried? So, you know, perhaps they cited the wrong rule, but the effect of their motion was to have this matter conform to the evidence that was taken at trial.
I understand Your Honor's point on that. Respectfully, I don't think it is the role of the district court to save counsel from poor pleadings. We have these rules for a reason. And
My
I
point, if
think.
I'm not being clear, counsel, is that you did not make that objection, right? You did not make the 115 objection in district court that you're making now. You made it after the fact, but you didn't make it at the time that the motion to consider was raised by respondent. So that's my point. So tell me.
If I'm understanding your point, Your Honor, it's that the court could have done this under a different motion and not under a motion to reconsideration.
I'm actually asking about your response. It's a different angle of what Judge Bjorkman asked you about. So your response to the motion to consider by respondents appears to waive the very technical point that you're now making. And I acknowledge that you made it to the district court. I'm not suggesting that you're making it for the first time on appeal, but you didn't make it until after the district court, you know, apparently processed your waiver. You're suggesting that the district court is somehow conveniently finding a rule to help out the respondents, and that's just not what happened, counsel.
Well, I think when you look at the rulings that we have as a whole, I mean, this goes through trial and they rule in Mr. Horn's favor. That's the outcome. And then the district court proceeds to muse that, gee, maybe there would have been evidence here, but you didn't plead it. And then it comes forward on a motion to reconsider. And initially, my recollection is that they in fact appealed, and we then and then there was an agreement to ask this court to hold pending the decision on the motion to reconsider. And then the district court uses the motion to reconsider to say, I'm going to consider this express agreement by express agreement as to boundary. And I think that procedural posture disadvantaged Mr. Horn in that this whole case would have been tried differently if this claim had been advanced. And it wasn't advanced until after we had a trial on this matter. So we didn't get to do the discovery. We didn't, the depositions turn out differently if you got a different claim. And instead, what we have is, I will acknowledge, a really weird procedural posture where basically the district court reverses itself on a request for reconsideration. And I think that that's the problem. And I think that in addition to that problem, then you move into the evidentiary problems.
So
And
let me understand you. I mean, it seems to be in some ways this is this case because we do have the unusual situation of a court saying in the initial order, yeah, there would have been a basis for boundary by practical location based on express agreement, but the parties didn't make that argument. When in fact corrected, as the record seems to do, especially the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, I mean, the district court basically said, yeah, I was wrong. Isn't that sort of the compelling circumstance that Rule 115.11 is designed to provide for?
Your Honor, that's not the way I read Rule 115.111. The compelling circumstance that I think that I contemplate would be like an intervening change in the law or something like that. We don't have that here. It's not, I don't read 115 to be a do-over for the lawyers. It's something changed in the law
But here it
or
wasn't a do-over. This was a do-over for the court. I mean, arguably the court was just wrong and acknowledged I'm just wrong when I said this wasn't raised because now I see, and you both seem to agree that in fact this argument was advanced and evidence supporting it was advanced at trial. I was wrong. I mean, it seems to me that is one of the purposes of 115.11 is to permit a district court to correct course, before you have to go on appeal to do so. I mean, why is the district court's use of Rule 115.11 inappropriate?
I think because what it does is it allows a new claim that had not been litigated all the way, and I want to be clear, litigated, because I freely acknowledge there was testimony to it. The point that I'm trying to make is that all of the underlying, the discovery, the depositions, the interrogs, the request for production of documents, all the tools that we have to basically make sure each side puts its cards on the table was lost because of the way that this was done. And I think that when I read, especially, and I'll be clear, it's really the 1997 comments to the rule, because the rule itself just doesn't have a lot of language. But as I read the comments and as we articulate in our brief, Rule 115.11 is not a tool for, oh, you could have pled this, but you forgot to. And that's exactly what it gets used to here. And I think that's a real problem. And then I think that it's compounded because of the evidentiary problems here, where ultimately what we're talking about is the statement, the sole evidence of an express agreement comes from someone who's deceased, and the only person who's making the statements about what the quote unquote agreement is the person who's stands to win an additional 13 acres. And I think that's highly problematic. And the district court kind of blends the lines in finding things like that this is a statement against interest, And ultimately, I think that had the court applied a more rigorous evidentiary standard, the proper evidentiary standard, it would have concluded that this statement should not have been allowed in because there was basically no one to testify to it but the only person who really benefited from that statement. And that's, I think, part of what compounds this. Is that because we didn't have the interrogatories, because we didn't have the request for production of documents, because we didn't have the depositions, he gets to come in and say this stuff at trial, and the court says, yep, good enough to establish a boundary by express agreement, and the parties haven't litigated that point. And so there's none of the tools that we use to try to verify these statements that are coming into play in this case, and instead it's been done by ambush, and after the fact, the court ratifies that via a request for reconsideration. I see my time is up. If I can, I'm sorry, the Marshall clock is rather small on my screen, but I believe I'm up.
That's correct, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel, for respondent. You can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Curtis Ripley. I'm the attorney for the respondents, Todd and Tiffany Wiedrich. And this court should affirm the district court's rulings that are at issue on the appeal because those rulings are firmly rooted in Minnesota law and well supported by the evidence. As the court was just discussing with counsel for the appellants here, this is a case that arose on a motion for reconsideration. There are actually three district court orders at issue here. The district court's initial ruling in favor of the appellants at trial, then Judge Benson's ruling on the respondent's motion for reconsideration, and then a third ruling on the appellant's motions for amended filings and a new trial. It's really orders two and three that are on issue here. And as the appellant's counsel was just arguing, they make the claim that the fundamental problem with the district court's rulings is that an entirely new argument was raised for the very first time on respondent's motion for reconsideration. Well, the facts in the record and the district court's orders make clear that that's not at all what happened.
It does seem to me, Mr. Ripley, that just looking at the initial pleading at the complaint, it's hard to divine. I mean, I know there are different ways that boundary by practical location can be established, but there was nothing in the complaint that really suggested that express agreement was going to be the path. How do you respond to Mr. Hansen's argument that this amounted to ambush because there nothing in the course of discovery that preceded the actual trial on the merits tipped the appellant off to the fact that this really was an express agreement case rather than a acquiescence for 15 years or something like that? Can you help me understand that?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Well, obviously, we have notice pleading in Minnesota, and complaints simply need to put the other side on notice of the types of claims that are being asserted. In this case, as the court observed before, the complaint does reference both adverse possession and boundary by practical location. And of course, the evidence of that came in very clearly at trial. The appellant is making this discovery argument for the very first time at this oral argument. Nowhere in the proceedings before the district court on any of these three orders that came up and were argued in front of the court below, and nowhere in their briefs to this court did they say, or did they establish any evidentiary foundation for some claim that no discovery was taken on this issue. Again, nothing in the district court record in the various motions and orders that came up to the district court or in the appellate court briefs in which they've identified whether or not this issue came up in discovery at all. So I don't think there would be a basis in the district court record for this court to reverse based on some conclusion that this wasn't at issue in discovery. The appellant just simply hasn't made that record. They also didn't object at trial when the evidence came in of this agreement between Todd Wiedrich and Delbert Horn to say, wait a minute, this is outside the bounds of discovery. This is ambush. The only objection they made at that time was that this was hearsay. And there was a lengthy debate on the hearsay issue, both at the trial and then, of course, in the post-trial rulings. The district court made its ruling that this was admissible, but no objection even at trial that this was outside of the pleadings or that they had not had a chance to take discovery on this issue. Then the court has noted our post-trial findings and conclusions that we submitted, which very expressly raised boundary by practical location, express agreement. There again, the appellant never stood up and said, hey, wait a minute, what's this? This is a new argument. We never took discovery on that issue, which would have been the time to object. Then again, when this came up before the district court and we filed our motion to reconsider, their attorney at the time conceded that that had been raised before at the trial court. There again, there was no argument that this was never a part of the case. No discovery had been taken. So this is really, this lack of discovery is a newfound argument that not only has never been argued before, despite multiple opportunities to do so, but for which there's simply no record anywhere of any way in which they were somehow deprived of discovery. The entire point of the motion to reconsider, which Judge Benson very, very thoroughly considered, wrote a very detailed, lengthy order, was her finding that this was, in fact, not a new issue, that this had been raised before, that the evidence did come in at trial, that the parties...
Let me ask you about that. You're certainly accurate in terms of the judge's order following the motion to reconsider, but the judge's order following trial is also pretty blunt, right? It says that plaintiffs have not pleaded or argued such a claim and defendant has not litigated such a claim by consent. So with that determination, how do we reconcile the outcome of this case being in your favor on a theory that was not pled and according to the district court, not argued, and that the defendant, now the appellant, did not litigate by consent?
I think Judge Benson reconsidered that on her motion to reconsider, and she went through the facts and evidence more carefully and considered everything. And as the court observed a moment ago, just concluded she was wrong on her initial ruling that this had not been raised before. And again, that motion to reconsider was very, very thoroughly briefed, argued, and carefully considered by the district court, who wrote a pretty lengthy opinion explaining how her initial...
Help me out, counsel, because those three comments made by the district court, where in the record is it shown that she was wrong about them? You already agreed you didn't plead the theory, right? You suggest that you've offered evidence in support of the theory during the bench trial, but you seem to acknowledge you didn't make the argument until your post-trial submissions, which is too late, right? I mean, post-trial submissions are too late to assert a new theory. And then the last comment that the district court made is that the defendants, the Horns, had not litigated it by consent. So I don't hear you saying that they litigated the issue, that theory, that particular theory, by agreement, express agreement, boundary by express agreement, by consent. So where did the district court go wrong in her initial conclusions about this theory?
So I think it was pled because we did plead boundary by practical location, and you're correct. We didn't specify all the subspecies of boundary by practical location. And then at trial, we did offer evidence that goes to express agreement. That was the testimony of Todd Wiedrich, in which he talked about his express agreement with Delbert Horn as to where the boundary would be. We've got a block quote of some of that testimony in our brief, which very clearly references an express agreement. And then time and time again, throughout Todd's testimony, we provide the transcript references. He says, you know, we had an express agreement. So that evidence was certainly offered at trial. and there was no objection at trial that this was a new theory, that this was not pled, that they had been ambushed, that this was not the subject of discovery. The only objection they made to that testimony was hearsay, which the district court properly overruled. Then after the trial findings and conclusions that we submitted simply corroborate that we had made that argument and offered that evidence at trial. And again, the appellant didn't object at that time that our findings and conclusions asked for relief that either hadn't been pled or hadn't been argued at trial. That's what the district court went through in her ruling on the motion for reconsideration. And she certainly didn't accept our arguments at face value. In fact, if anything, Judge Benson was probably a bit skeptical as her ruling on the motion for reconsideration makes clear. But when she went back through the trial and the evidence and the lack of objections, she concluded she was simply wrong and that this argument had been raised. In terms of the evidentiary issue that was mentioned by counsel for the appellant, there were two reasons why Todd Wiedrich's testimony regarding his conversation with Delbert Horn as to the express agreement properly came in over a hearsay objection. The first one is really Hornbeck evidence law, and that is when you have an oral conversation that goes to the formation of and the terms of an express oral agreement, that's not hearsay. That's the law that's been recognized in Minnesota for over 100 years. We cite cases going back to the 1920s, which have held that oral statements that go to the formation of a contract are not hearsay. We cite a number of cases.
But as I understand it, counsel, the verbal act principle has its limits. I mean, you have to have, you know, I think that, and we'll probably hear more from appellant's counsel in the rebuttal on sort of what's the appropriate scope of that, of the verbal act principle. You know, it seems to me it's a fine line between saying, yes, it's being admitted to show that there was this agreement, but isn't that the truth of the matter asserted? Help me understand the proper scope of verbal act evidence.
Certainly. And there have been a number of cases that have dealt with exactly that issue, which is this going to the existence of the agreement or to the truth of the matter asserted? Well, of course, the issue here in the case is whether or not there was a verbal agreement between Todd Wiedrich and Delbert Horn. And so what the verbal act doctrine allows is for testimony regarding that conversation to come in for the purpose of showing, number one, that an agreement was made, and then number two, what those terms are. That's the verbal act doctrine. And so what those terms are here, of course, is that the boundary is the fence and the field line. That's how the verbal act doctrine has been applied, again, for many decades in Minnesota and in other jurisdictions as well. That can come in to show, again, the existence of the agreement and the terms. To the extent there are, you know, sort of concerns about that, then sometimes the courts will look to corroborating evidence. Is there other evidence in the record which would show that type of statement is reliable, that it's accurate? And in this case, all the other evidence in the record supported the fact that this fence and field line was indeed the boundary. The Wiedrichs occupied and farmed this property up to that fence and field line from the moment they purchased it. Not only did Delbert Horn not object, but he actually assisted them with farming it. This had been the boundary that was used not just between Delbert and the Wiedrichs, but going back several years before with prior renters. This is a field line that was plainly visible from both the ground and the air. So there's really no reason to suspect that this conversation regarding the agreement was anything other than true. One of the objections that Mr. Hansen just made to this is, well, wait a minute, Delbert Horn is dead, and how is it fair that Todd Wiedrich can testify about a conversation with him through which Mr. Wiedrich would benefit now that Delbert has passed? What he's talking about there is the dead man statute. There used to be a rule in Minnesota that did exactly what Mr. Hansen said, If you're talking about a conversation with a deceased person and that conversation would somehow benefit you or you had some skin in the game there, you could not testify as to that conversation. That statute was repealed decades ago. It was replaced by the rules of evidence in which you can testify as to a conversation with a deceased person. And then the courts look to other indicia of reliability or the accuracy of that statement. And that's how we get to all the other evidence in the record here that corroborates the existence of this agreement pursuant to which the fence and the field line was the boundary. Again, it's hard to find a case in which all that other corroborating evidence could be much more clear. Not only did Delbert not object to that, but he actually assisted the Weidrichs in farming this disputed portion of the property. Even after Delbert passed, Michael didn't raise this issue for several years. And so it's pretty obvious in the record that there was an agreement as to the fence and field line, and this testimony properly came in over a hearsay objection. The other grounds that this statement was admitted was that this would be a statement against Delbert's interest. Even if it was hearsay, it would come in as a statement against interest because the effect of the statement at the time would have been that Delbert lost 13 and a half acres of property. That's
Did he even know, is there any evidence that Delbert knew that? It seemed like when this transaction was made back in 2011, nobody knew where the actual boundary line was.
Well, it is the line that he had used with all of his tenants for several years before, and whether he knew it at the time of the sale to Todd or not, not clear what the evidence of the record would say about that, but sometime after the sale, while he was still alive, Michael brought this to Delbert's attention and said, you know, Delbert, I think this may not be the proper line. The line may be somewhere else. And Delbert specifically instructed Michael to let it go. So there is evidence in the record that Delbert knew about this, but nonetheless made the agreement with the Weidrichs that the fence and field line would be the boundary.
Thank you, counsel. I do see that your time is up.
Yes. Thank you.
We will reset the clock for 5 minutes. All right, Mr. Hansen, you can begin your rebuttal when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to start following up on Judge Bjorkman's question regarding verbal act. And I do definitely think that the argument being made by counsel and the argument used by the district court blurs a distinction that this court should not allow to be blurred. Verbal act, it's very clear, and we cite this in our brief, that the court was using it for two purposes, the supposed statement by Delbert. He was using it, one, to establish an agreement, but two, also to fix a boundary line. And I don't think that the verbal act is so broad. And we've cited, obviously, the case law that supports that, but that's a fairly fine distinction. But again, this goes to our overwhelming problem here, which is what's the reliability of the statement that we're making these decisions on. And here, what we have is somebody who's gone, and the person who is benefiting from that is the one coming in and saying, oh, yeah, he was really clear about this. I think that that's a problem. I think that the district court can admit it for a limited purpose, and that limited purpose is to establish that there was an agreement between the parties. But I don't think you can also, in addition to it, use it to establish the line. And that's what the court did here, and I think that's a problem.
Well, but I think I understand. I mean, the agreement here, when you say it can be used to establish the agreement, as I understand it, is you pay me, what was it, $85,000, you get the land from west of the fence field division. I mean, those are the terms of the agreement, right? It's not just I'm selling you this. I mean, part of that agreement, by its terms, was how am I marking? What part am I selling? Now, whether that's the same as the legal boundary, I get that's a different question. But it seemed I have a hard time understanding your argument that the sort of bound the boundary or the you get the land west of the fence isn't an express term of this agreement.
I think that it goes to, you can't use that term to establish, you know, under our case law about what constitutes an express agreement. I don't think that you get there. I think that that our language, and there's a number of cases where this court has thought about things like, how do we know where the line is? And this statement, the one we got in this record, is basically everything over there to the west. That's what you get. And I don't think that that is rises to the level of precision that this court has historically endorsed in what's effectively redrawing property lines. And that, I think, is the problem, that the court could say, okay, well, there was an agreement about farming over there. Yes, I can accept it for the limited purpose, but I can't accept it for both the limited purpose and to define a boundary line between these parcels. And I think that that distinction, while a fine one, is an important one. And it really comes back to, you know, all of our jurisprudence about, you know, like some of the other cases that are cited by both parties in the briefs, where the court has said, you know, field lines move year to year. You know, we're not going to allow these things to, you know, kind of have this hazy definition. We're not going to use that for our property records. And that's what we've got here, where it's this generalized statement of you can mow over there by the field line and fence line. And to be clear, that I mean, if the statement was you can mow west of the fence line, and the fence line isn't the whole of the boundary, that isn't our case. We've got this combination of field and fence line, and they're all moving targets. And basically, the district court accepts that as boundary. And I think that that's a problem. And I think that our rules of evidence.
But
let it
that
in
argument,
for a very specific purpose.
But that doesn't your argument really go to the, okay, there's an agreement, but is the agreement one that sets up an exact, precise line? I mean, that's a whole different element of the claim, it seems to me. And that clearly there was other evidence offered about that, both the leasing of to other farmers before the sale and, you know, Mr. Weider, Rick's testimony regarding how he used the land while Delbert was still alive. But I'm confused between, does the agreement get in as agreement with then the plaintiffs here having to prove exact precision of that line and acquiescence for a considerable amount of time?
That would be my take on how the district court could have allowed it in. That there was an agreement and for that purpose only. And it's clear that the court did much more with that statement. And in the boundaries of this case as a whole, I think that that requires reversal, because we shouldn't have, you know, going back to this, shouldn't have been done on a motion for reconsideration. Then we have these evidentiary problems, and basically all of the protections fall apart, and we end up with a bad case where the facts are ultimately the person who benefits by redrawing the line is the sum total of the evidence that we get in front of the court. And I think that's what requires reversal. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your briefing as well as your oral argument. That was very helpful. This matter is submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the required timeline. With that, counsel, you are free to log off at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, counsel.